The baby boomers led waves of dramatic culture changes. Their voices raise awareness of consumerism, retirement programs, higher education, healthcare, and civil rights transformations. Now, the baby boomers have reached an age where it is our turn to give back to them for their voices, their struggles, and their footprint on the society we benefit from today. Boomer Living Podcast is dedicated to the support and the enhancement of senior living and the baby boomers' needs and demands. We welcome conversations between caregivers, providers, gerontologists, geriatricians, neurologists, technologists, developers, and operators with one objective: to serve our baby boomers. By bringing together these experts and the baby boomers' families, we can share our knowledge that will educate and inspire others on how to care for the baby boomers. We're a social platform that focuses on the respect and care of this aging population that gave their youth and their wisdom to the society we benefit from today. So how are you?
Good. No, not too bad.
Yeah.
I see that you've been busy with lots of podcasts, huh?
Podcasting allow us to meet people that have the same goals, objectives, and hopefully make a difference for the aging population.
Very good. I'm very, very pleased to have made the connection.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's wonderful. And I think when it comes to the aging journey, we're all on that journey. And if we can do a good job for our, whether it's parents or grandparents, that's what's going to look like for us too. Right.
Yeah. So I've just put my mother into a dementia facility. So it's working out better than what I thought it would be. And it's not in New Zealand. Unfortunately, it's actually back in Malaysia.
Malaysia.
So, which was quite challenging because it was right in the middle of COVID. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, I think that your point around us being on a journey, us having to look at making, helping our parents transition into that late stage, and then watching their experiences and actually also reflecting and thinking about what's it going to be like when we get there.
On a personal note, my mom has been in dementia care for about 5 years. It was a very bad experience. And I didn't know much back then, but now that I do, when I came to the senior living, it was primarily because of the real estate. I'm more of an engineer, analytical finance type of person. So I'm interested in the development side of it. But as I am on that journey, I realize that's not what aging is about. It's not about real estate. We know it's important because we do need a home. We do need it to be affordable, and we want it to be in the right location so we still can see our family. That's a big component, but that is certainly not the only component. So as I stay on that learning process, I realize the stuff that are not talked about is like so much bigger, right?
Yeah.
And the stuff that's not talked about is the very thing that we are talking about, such as aging journey, longevity, purpose. That's a lot. You know, we should get started. So we have a very interesting guest today on Boomer Living, and I'm very excited to get things started. So Chai Chua, welcome. Welcome to Boomer Living.
Thank you, Han. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So let's start by having you share with our audience a little bit about yourself. Where are you from and what projects are you working on right now?
So I'm actually a Malaysian-born Chinese. I was born in Malaysia, in Penang, but I came to New Zealand for my university education, started my working career in New Zealand. Did go back to Asia to work for a couple of years, but eventually came back to New Zealand. So I've been in New Zealand for over 35 years. I'm a trained chartered accountant by profession, but in most of my career has been in healthcare. So I have the unique opportunity of being the only Asian to have actually been appointed as the head of a government public service department, which is the Ministry of Health. So I spent about 8 years in the bureaucracy, as they call it. So I got a front row seat to actually see how decisions are made by politicians, by senior public servants. And that has really given me a good insight into what works and what doesn't work. So I resigned from my position before I finished my contract on matter of principle because we had a change in government and I felt that I was not in a position to be able to support the policies of the incoming government. So rather than feeling frustrated working inside government, I thought I'd do the decent thing by allowing them to actually appoint a new director general so that I can be freed up to do what I think is really important. So coming back to the projects that I'm working on, so there are three particular focus areas. The first one is, so what does the future of healthcare look like for systems around the world? The second project I'm working on is, you can have the best strategy, all the money in the world, and all the technology. It is always about the leadership that counts most. So that's my second passion, which is about helping to identify and develop future leaders. And third and foremost, which is probably the subject of our conversation today, is I'm very interested in looking at better care options for our seniors and our elderly. And there's a number of reasons for that, but so there's a personal reason in the sense that my mum's 89 and my siblings and I just had put her into a dementia facility. But on a more professional and a systems level, if you look hard enough at any health jurisdiction, most of their issues and expenditure are in healthcare of the elderly. And most systems are not doing that well. So there's a lot of common strands there on the three areas I'm focusing on.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your mission. And I hope out of this conversation that we can find ways that we can add value to this aging journey. It's very much needed for the elderly care and the aging population worldwide. I know how different New Zealand's healthcare and elder care system looks compared to the United States. Can you start by telling us some of the key differences so our audience is aware?
So I will probably spend more time on the New Zealand system and touch very lightly on the US system. And if I'm not quite right there, please let me know. Sure. So the New Zealand health system, first of all, in terms of context, New Zealand is a very small country with a very small population relative to the US. So New Zealand only has a population of 5 million people, and the land area, it's only 268,000 square meters, whereas the US has got 9,900 square meters. So it's huge compared to New Zealand. So the aging population in New Zealand at this point in time is roughly the same in percentage as the US, roughly around 15-16%. Okay. And I think that if I look at the projections going out to 2050, I think both our countries heading towards that 22-25% mark, depending on which source you look at. So our health system and therefore our aged care system each largely funded by the government. And the New Zealand government funds our healthcare through a public taxation system. And although New Zealand citizens have to pay, it is a very small proportion. So I think in the US, most of your funding comes from some level of public and private insurance system. Mm-hmm. Whereas New Zealand, the insurance side of things is solely in the private sector. And it is a tiny proportion of how the New Zealand health system is funded. So for aged care, generally, you are entitled to receive different types of aged care services. And here we are concentrating largely more around home support as well as residential services. So generally, those services are free. Mm-hmm. On the basis that when the time comes, when you are deemed that you need those services, and generally it's the GP or our primary care physician that will make an assessment and say you probably need to go and get yourself checked out and see whether you qualify for the services. And if you do, there is an asset and income testing process, and subject to that, you will receive full or partial government subsidy for whether it's home care services or residential. So the asset income testing is not very onerous. It's not a huge barrier for most people accessing the service. So if you like, it is a universal health access service for aged care.
That's very interesting. Do you believe there are some aspects of aged care in New Zealand that might be farther ahead than the United States? And if so, how would you recommend the elder care workers in the U.S. to act to get up to date with what's going on to New Zealand?
So putting aside the basis of funding, because I think that that's a big policy issue, but if I were to look purely at the models of care. Mm-hmm. So I think that the interesting thing with the New Zealand models of care is it's currently sitting at a huge fork in the road. Now, New Zealand system is not that different from the Australian one. Mm-hmm. If you were keeping an eye on the Australian system at the moment, they are going through a major Royal Commission of Inquiry into the aged care system. And when I read the interim report, it is almost identical to what I'm seeing in New Zealand. So both Australia and New Zealand are sitting at a turning point. Now, I think that the thing that I would say to people listening to this podcast is that it is the aspiration of a number of us that the New Zealand models of care starts to move towards much more of a system where some of the things we touched on earlier, Han, around how do we involve the families early? Mm-hmm. How do we move away purely from a focus on facilities, on the medical condition, and looking at the disability, individual disability of the elderly, into looking at supporting them on their purpose as they get older, which changes quite significantly. So I think it's a principle-based model, and I think that New Zealand will go through a difficult transition because we have to unbundle all the legacy of what is still a very medicalized model. Mm-hmm. And a model that looks at the disability of an individual rather than a person's well-being. And there is, and in the residential part of the services, it is hugely focused on facilities.
Yeah.
And lastly, I would touch, technology is extremely rudimentary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'll add to one thing. When you talk about emphasis on the older adult medically, in terms of what's wrong with them, what's wrong with you, all these medical issues around the individual, as opposed to providing a setting that lends itself for wellness, engagement, vibrancy, purpose, right? Yeah. Celebration, regardless of any age, regardless of any acuity. I get it. As your health declines, nobody wants to celebrate that. I get that. I walk through that journey. But I believe as we all are heading in the same direction, we ought to embrace and globally the attitude that, listen, as we age, every milestone has something that is beautiful. It is to be celebrated and honored and respect, as opposed to being shameful. Because I think aging, whether it's New Zealand, Australia, or the U.S., it is still considered to be frowned upon. It's looked at as frail, weak, maybe even useless. And that is so wrong. And we need to shift that paradigm to be looked at wisdom, a wealth of knowledge. And as some of these people are also still very entrepreneur. They were when they were 40s, 30s, 50s. Why would that stop just because they moved into an assisted living?
Yeah, I think the fact that people are living longer. I think that when we look at the definition of an aging population, I think there are different cohorts. And within each cohort, there is a real mix of groups of people in there. Someone in their 80s could be absolutely, you know, the top of the game. They have all the time in the world, all the experience in the world, and all the resources in the world. Right? And what society generally does is to actually ignore them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think that if I were to look at my parents' generation, they get to the point where they're saying, okay, if you're going to ignore me, I'll just move aside and quietly retire into the horizon, right? Now, I think that's going to be very different with a different cohort of the baby boomers generation coming through. So I'm the baby boomer. And when I talk to all my classmates whom, you know, whom I've been recently put in touch with, and when I have listened to the conversation, none of them are ready to be actually to sit down on a rocking chair and you know, have a drink in the evening and read a book with the glasses on there. None of them are. They've got issues of some health issues, but they know that despite having those illnesses and this sort of stuff, that shouldn't stop them because the mind is still very active. They have lots of ideas to achieve and contribute. So I think that's where I think that the future of caring for the health and the elderly needs to pivot away from looking at it as a disability, looking at curing someone's condition, helping them to sort of do, keeping them safe. That's actually one of the biggest issues at the moment, especially with COVID, is in the interest of keeping the elderly safe, they have just taken away all sorts of basic things.
So
I think we can talk about that later.
Right. Yeah. Where do you balance safety and engagement and still provide a setting for these folks who thrive is a challenge. So I agree with everything that you're saying with regard to the outlook and perceiving the older adults. And I think by, let's say, you and I talking about it and putting it out there, and I am sure that there are so many folks that believe the same way. And it starts with everybody, because I think too often we complain about the culture attitude towards aging is frowned upon. But guess what?
Yeah.
We are all a part of that culture. So instead of blaming the culture, talking about the culture, we're in it. So it takes every single one of us, you and I, and the person around us, so we all can be a part of that shift. So that's why that's another reason I believe this is so important. The driving force behind Boomer Living is start discussing about those topics that perhaps at one time frowned upon. But your and my and many people's attitude towards it is like, let's embrace it, because this is, you know, the third part of life, and we're going to use the wisdom that we've acquired over these years to make an impact wherever you are, and also to the younger generation. So I think it's great. I think it just starts from talking about it and taking action as opposed to blaming the culture.
Yeah. So I think the beginning of wisdom is to have the conversation and the knowledge. And I think our collective aspiration is to convert that this conversation and knowledge into some sort of an action. My personal view is, having worked in the system for so long, I think the system will be very slow to change, and it needs the driving force of a consumer movement. Right. And it's people like you and I making decisions for our elderly parents or relatives, and actually for ourselves, that is actually going to actually be the difference that will shift and change the current system to where we need it to go.
I echo that. Yes, absolutely true. So let me ask you, can you talk a little bit about the impact of COVID in senior living?
So one of the things I've been doing is, because I was actually trapped overseas for 4 months, because I was in Malaysia trying to work through my siblings on future care for my mother. So I had the luxury of being away from New Zealand and actually watching and doing a lot of reading and listening to what's happening around the country, around the world, around the impact of COVID on the elderly. Now, there's a consistent theme, regardless of what countries you look at. Right? Even in New Zealand, also New Zealand's been held out as a model of having managed well this thus far. But I think the consistent theme is, when it comes to COVID, everybody kind of recognizes that one of the at-risk groups is the elderly. And as a result, the safety of the elderly becomes paramount. And the general response to keeping the elderly safe is to shut them away. and to isolate them from each other. So even within any residential facilities, they can't even mingle. But to isolate them from staff, so the usual free flow of staff, now you have dedicated people to just look after you, so you can't have the broader range of staff. So, you know, any therapies, any music or physical activities, all those things are basically limited or gone. And then, of course, there is the issues around visitors, families, and friends. Those in many countries, what I'm saying is, you know, we get this ridiculous situation where, okay, we'll just use technology or people can't wave at each other from the at the windows. And actually, that's actually happening in New Zealand. So let's not think that New Zealand's in a special place. And when I look at that, and I was personally, I'm appalled. And I reflected on that if this was happening when I'm still in the job, that would not be my recommendation for a politician. Now, they may or may not actually agree with me, but that I would be a strong advocate for not doing this crazy stuff. Because your point around the balance between safety and someone's overall well-being, I always will go for the overall well-being. You have to take extra steps to actually mitigate any possible infections for the elderly. But in the end, I think if you actually look at what is happening with all the elderly mentally, physically deteriorating, you know, right before our eyes, obviously it's crazy safety response. And there's a lot of good people in aged care trying to do their level best. But I think that they're just following the system. So this is my observation. I think that I don't think COVID's going away. So I think 2021 will be equally challenging, if not more challenging than 2020. Right. There's a few upsides coming up, but in terms of impact on daily living, for including senior living, it will be equally, if not more challenging in 2021. Okay. So coming back to your point around, we have to make a difference in individual response. So I wrote to the owners of the facility that I shifted my mother into. And it's a new service, and I talked regularly with the owners, and I said to them, I reminded the owners what was their purpose of saying on the service, which was to actually allow the people to have a home and to have a purpose, to have meaning, to have connections. And I said, you are going to have waves of COVID community spreads. If you respond with every wave by just locking them up and locking people out, it's not the right thing to do. And I said, certainly for my mother, she will not do well. And I said to her, to the owners, you can tell us what we need to do, but you cannot tell us that we cannot visit our mother. You can tell us what we need to do, but you cannot. You can tell us it's only 1 hour a day, you know, and that's fine. And so the good news is, despite the subsequent wave that the country is getting hit with in back in Malaysia, they have honored that. So they remain open every day for a designated family member to always come and see the resident. So to me, that's a tangible evidence that we have the conversation early enough if we are clear around our expectations. But we actually have to support the providers because I think at the moment they are able to do that because the government regulations are ambiguous. But if you get a crazy situation where the government's regulations or instructions are clear and they basically say it's illegal to do that, there will be all sorts of problems. And if you look at the stats in most of the European, even Canada and the US, and even in New Zealand, we have 25-26 people who have died. 16 to 18 of the 26 people are actually from aged care facility. So the trend's the same, right?
Right.
So with COVID,
it doesn't matter what country you're in.
It doesn't matter what country, doesn't what the number is. The impact is the same once you isolate and shut them out. So I think there's a lot of work. There's a lot of advocacy that I think that people like you and I need to do to support the providers to make sure that as much as they can within the regulation that's set up by government. They cannot shut out us from our parents and our older relatives.
I don't think I can add any more to what you just said. I echo your comments. If the virus doesn't kill you, the loneliness, the isolation, the mental health, all of that will.
Yeah.
It could easily kill you too. And it's, I don't even want to think in those terms, but that's reality.
So I just want to end this segment of a conversation with a positive comment.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually read somewhere, I think it's actually in the States or in Canada, that because of the restrictive access that family members were having to the elderly in the in residential facility, mm-hmm. I think it's one of the wives who actually was very creative, and she persuaded the operators of the residential facility to employ her as a cleaner or dishwasher so that she could work there and she actually had access to her husband. And I think that we need to think like that. So I actually use that as an example with the facility that my mom's in. And I actually did say to the people to say, if there ever came to a time when you things are out of your hands to not allow visitors, then I think you need to look at some casual contracts for family members.
Yeah. Come up with a solution so the family members can still be engaged and integral to their loved ones.
Yeah. Yeah. As much as I like technology and I'm a great fan of technology, I think it's not by anywhere close to being enough to support the elderly in a COVID situation.
Yeah, I agree. I am a tech enthusiast. I love technology. And obviously, here's the reason why. It puts people like you and I in connection. So I love technology. But I also am a believer that technology during COVID has been a savior, but it is only an alternative. That is not the solution.
It's a backup that is actually, the phrase that comes to my mind is, no matter how cool and how good the technology is, it will never substitute holding your mother's hand.
Yeah.
It will never substitute sitting with mom and watching her eat her fruits or her meal. You know, it's not the conversation sometimes, you know, because mom has dementia. Sometimes not the conversation, it's the physical presence and the touching. Mm-hmm. That's really important.
Yeah. And here's the other thing too, depending on the stage of dementia.
Yeah.
They get scared of technology. In other words, I experienced that. We used to stay in touch with my mom. I'm the youngest of 10. So we try to stay in touch with her through what we're doing, Zoom and so forth. But then it came to the point she got scared.
Yeah.
Because seeing all these people on the screen coming at her, going in and out.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
I said, technology is great. It is great. I'm not against that at all. But depending on your loved ones, where they are, it won't work. And then just like you said, it is nowhere than being present next to your loved ones, hugging them, taking them for a walk. But I think for the time being, I get it. It's a savior, and we're going to have to make do with what we have. So thank you for sharing that. I'm going to move on to a different topic here. So we're undergoing a generational shift in the world. Aged care clients are shifting from the silent generation to the baby boomer. So how do you think this will change elder care?
Oh,
and
massive.
Also, what are the biggest challenges will this pose?
So I think that the big shift is a swing towards informed consumers. And I say this quite a lot, when I was in the job, I keep saying to my professional colleagues, I said, right now, you're dealing with the silent generation. These people are very compliant. They don't ask a lot of questions. And even when things doesn't suit them, they don't really complain. They put up with a lot. And largely because it's the values of that generation, that sort of stuff. They're grateful for whatever help they can get, even if it doesn't quite work that well for them. And I said, when you look at the baby boomers generation, and again, it's those born between 46 to 64, and again, there are different cohorts in there, right? So stuff. You're gradually moving into a consumer group that is getting more access to information and has the ability to be more knowledgeable and informed, and in some cases, actually have resources and they look at what is available for the parents. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, they're saying, actually, that's not good enough. And I actually want something different and better for myself. And I think, and you're in real estate, you're in business, you understand that in the end, business will respond to customer shift. So I am a big fan of saying, I think we just need to watch what happens when 25% of traditional market, right, shift and demand a different model. Right. You know, the example I use quite a lot is, so in New Zealand, we have retirement villages. This is independent living, the holiday resorts, community, this sort of stuff. And it's a booming business, right? So stuff. And they are, despite COVID, they are, you know, expanding at an exponential rate. And the basis of that is that there's going to be a huge demand for that sort of facility, right? Now, it's, and you and I talked earlier that I think they increasingly were realizing that services for the elderly is not just about the physical and the tangible things. It's the intangible stuff that needs to go alongside the tangible stuff. And I exactly. think that's what's missing. And also the flips, the other thing that I think there would be a difference is the baby boomers will want to be as independent for as long as possible. Mm-hmm. And they want to have choices for as long as possible. Mm-hmm. And they want to continue to connect, and they want to continue to make contribution.
Mm-hmm.
I think that those are.
Yeah. I love it. Everything you're saying is like principally, fundamentally, it aligns with what I believe and my vision. Yeah. So I'm so glad that we connected.
Yeah. So I think that the more we energize our generation, and actually not to do it ourselves, because I think we need to take the younger people with us. Mm-hmm. Our children and our grandchildren with us, because it's important for them to actually see why, how we're doing it, why we're doing it. Because I think that when we get to the point when we need support and help, they need to understand why we make the decisions we're making.
Mm-hmm.
So in the journey right now, it's important to actually get them involved in the journey, you know, because I think they have their own journey when they get to our stage. I'm almost sure it'll be different.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the basic principles remain the same. It's about what drives us, is about choices, it's about independence, it's about connections, and it's about contribution.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And yep, it will be the same for them, but their specifics will be different from us.
I agree.
Yeah. So I think that I'm very excited by what our generation is going to actually be driving. And I think that the providers actually are not quite aware what's coming.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I spend quite a bit of time trying to talk to the more enlightened providers and actually trying to persuade them to actually change their service model and their business model, because both those don't work for me at the moment.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I know there's a lot of positive things on the horizons, but I think it starts with looking at if they themselves are moving into what they're constructing. Okay, so a forward feedback. Whatever you're doing right now for the residents, you have to envision that something you're doing for yourself. It's full circle. Yeah. So be very mindful. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I know you speak and write about developing the leaders that we need to better care for seniors. And why is that a passion of yours? And how is developing leadership skills in the aged care industry compared to the other countries?
That really comes up from an observation that I made in the last 10 years of my previous career.
Mm-hmm.
And I was involved in a very high-level ministerial review at the entire, looking at the entire health system. And I was part of an amazing team of people that was from business and academics and stuff. And the recommendations itself, I looked at it and thinking, this is going to be quite earth-shattering. It will fundamentally change the system if we can pull this thing off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 10 years later, almost none of it actually was effectively done. Now, the reason for that, I realized, was that we were designing laser guns and we were giving it to people who only knows how to shoot bows and arrows. then I realized it's about the people who are holding positions of responsibility and leadership that has to change. Mm-hmm. So we can have the best strategy in the world, all the resources in the world, all the technology in the world. But if the mindset, the capability, the talent, the knowledge of the people who are leaders and who aspire to be leaders cannot keep up, then we will always struggle. Mm-hmm. And one of the common things that I see quite a lot, and I emphasize that a lot with a lot of the younger people that I spend time with, is here's a very simple litmus test of whether you're in trouble with leadership. If you look at your senior leaders or your middle-level managers, leaders, if they have stopped learning, you are immediately in trouble. Because once they stop learning, and it's very easy to spot because they always say the same things.
They're stuck. And that's why they're saying the
they're
same
stuck.
Thing.
Yeah,
You stop learning, you're stuck, and you have a fixed mindset. You're not open.
Absolutely right.
Others, and you're not looking ahead because you're still right here. You're stuck.
Yeah, yeah. And there's always a blame game. It's always somebody else's fault. So the leadership thing, emphasis I put on this stuff is because I see a lot of this stuff right now, and I there are some good people in there, but I think that them being good actually doesn't mean they're good, they're effective leaders. And the common theme I'm seeing is a failure to keep learning. And also I think is a lack of courage to do the right thing. Yeah. And most of the time they spend a lot of time looking down into all the mess and the difficulties and the risk and this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And they don't spend any time looking up or looking around or looking far. So I said to the people I support, I said, my job is to work with you, is to learn how to look up, to look around.
We look up together.
Yeah.
Let's look up together.
Yeah. Right? Because when you look up and you look around, you suddenly realize there are other people around you. And then the next challenge, actually, how do you work with them all? Mm-hmm. Right. And then I think looking far is quite important because the future is coming at a fast rate. Because if you don't look far, you're going to get run over by a truck before you realize.
Absolutely. And you know what? 10,000 folks turning 65 plus every day. So you better look far and you better look quick, right?
Quick.
Exactly. Yeah. I love the fact that you said courage because I think it's very true. Because here's the thing, why people don't talk about the stuff that you and I are talking right now. Because it's frowned upon. It's unsexy. It's not glamorous.
Yeah.
And it's all about decline. At least in their mind, it's about decline. But what we're trying to do is change that paradigm shift to promote the aging journey to be engagement, vibrancy, purposeful wellness, and celebrate it at any age, whether you're 65, 85, or 90 plus. Technology is a big deal, but I think it's still easier than getting the culture to have a paradigm shift.
I think the technology presents an entirely different type of challenge, which even if you master that, you will struggle to try and cope with the challenges of how do you actually design much better care for seniors, right? Mm-hmm. Now, because when you can't get involved as you and I have at a very personal level of looking at supporting someone that you care and love about who is aging and and is moving along that whole continuum, right? You can't realize that actually it's not an easy decision. Every decision you make, it's not purely on facts. It's not purely on money. It's not purely on facility. It's not purely, on technology. And in the end, you're sitting there looking at the person you're trying and whom you care deeply about, and you're trying to figure out actually what is the right thing to do for that person. And you question whether or not the criteria you use to make decision is actually theirs.
Yeah.
And there's this conflict that goes on. And that's the thing that technology doesn't give you.
Because you're human. You're human. You use technology when it's appropriate, but like what you just described, the moment of making that decision, it's about human. Yeah. And it's about trust, in my mind. At that moment, is who has the best interest for my mom? Who will care for her when I'm around?
I had this quite difficult conversation because I stayed 4 months in Penang, Malaysia until my mom, until facilities was open and she was the first person to move in, which was great. And I stayed 4 days to make sure she was settled in, and then I had to come back to New Zealand because I'd been away for 4 months. And after I came back, a couple of weeks after I came back, mom had a stroke.
Mm.
And I have only one sibling living close to her, and she's my sister, closest to me, when you're younger than me. And she was in a difficult position. And fortunately, the facility got her to a private hospital in time. And she was bombarded by all these questions and options, how to care for her. And she said to me, will you talk to the doctors? I said, yeah, I'll talk to the doctor. So I talked to the doctor. It was very interesting because the neurologist said to me, your mom's got a stroke. We have to thrombolyze her quickly. And there's a window. We don't do it within that window. Her outlook's not that great. Mm-hmm. Problem is the mom's got high blood pressure and we can't do the thrombolysis until the BP's come down. I said, yeah, I get that. And then he said, however, there's a new treatment and you have to make the decision now. And he explained the position to me and I was busy Googling it while he was talking. And I realized it was an invasive procedure. Mm. And I said to the neurologist, I said, if it was your mother, what would you do? There was a slight pause there, and that tells a lot. Mm-hmm. And he said, given your mother's age and a general medical condition, I would need to talk. I would want to talk to all my siblings. I said, Doc, that's all I wanted to hear. I said, here's my decision. I said, and I'll take responsibility for that for all my siblings. I'm the eldest, so I kind of have some sort of moral ability to say that. I said, we're not going to do the alternative you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
He says, do you realize what it means? I say, I know exactly what it means. I says, if you can't bring her BP down and you start to thrombolyze later, her outlook won't be good, but you will do your best.
Mm-hmm.
He said, yes. And I said, I do not want anybody poking and cutting my mom up at 89 with all the risk involved.
Yeah.
And I want to give her that peace of mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I'd share it with you because I think that that's the old system speaking. They put the pressure. And I said to my sister, if I didn't have the experience, the exposure, I would have found myself in a far more difficult position. It didn't make the choices easier from the point of view of saying, if I make the wrong decision, mom could die here.
Mm-hmm.
That choice doesn't go away. But I think that given the experience and kind of the exposure I had, so I said, I'm prepared to actually make a balanced view. And because in the end, I think all of us, and I said to my sister, mom wants, if she has to die, she wants to die with dignity. She does not want to die with tubes and infusions and all sorts of crazy stuff around her. She's going to get really pissed off if she knows we did that.
Yeah. I feel the same way. Something similar like that happened to my mom too. There's medical reasons that, or treatment that has repercussions, and it takes someone with balanced thoughts, process to make that decision. And there comes a time when you do one treatment, there are side effects, and then you do another and another. So then at this point in time, it's really medically driven. And looked at as what is wrong with you as opposed to what really matters to you at this point. And we all have to weigh that out. So,
Han, I was going to ask you, have you read the book by, called Being Mortal?
You're going to have to send me that. I've heard of that book.
I'll text you, I'll give you the details so you can download from Amazon. It's written by a very eminent ethnically Indian, but born in the US. Mm-hmm. He is a very well-renowned author, surgeon, and well-known internationally. And I love this book of his because it is so different from his other books because it talks about his experience caring for his dying father.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And to in the epilogue at the end of the book, I love this sentence he used. He said, "We have been wrong about why we are here for," as I'm paraphrasing, "as health professionals. We thought we are here to save lives, to cure diseases, mm-hmm. and to fix people's illness. But actually, our real purpose is to support an individual on their life's journey and their purpose for living."
Mm-hmm.
It was, so when you read it, he writes it a lot better than the way I've said it. I thought it was such a powerful, and I use that quite a lot, even when I was working, to remind all the health professionals, I said, this is actually your real calling, not to actually do all this, you know, crazy stuff.
So true. So true. I'll have to get that book, and I'm going to have to give that to my daughter. She is starting medical school. So I want her to keep that in mind.
Yeah, because my second daughter is an anesthetist. I think we used to call it an anesthetologist, something like that. Mm-hmm. And she heard him speak at a conference.
Mm-hmm.
And she texts me, and it was a conference in Hong Kong, and she texts me, she said, "Wow, have you heard of this guy?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Read his book." And that has actually helped change her mm-hmm. as a doctor. And actually, that book is actually quite helpful for, I would say, anybody who's caring for a loved one who's dying.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very powerful book that talks about some raw emotions, some difficult choices. But in the end, it's about what this very famous health professional realized, what the real purpose is for him as a very eminent surgeon.
Wonderful, wonderful. I for sure will look for your email for that book. I will definitely take it, give it a look. Is there anything else that you would like to share with the audience?
I think you had the last question around the public-private partnership in healthcare.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think that the delivery of healthcare will always be a partnership, not just between the public sector and private sector, but also with civil society and actually with consumers. It's always a partnership. I think that regardless of what is the sources of funding, whether it's through insurance or taxation or et cetera, so stuff, when you look at the delivery of services, given our conversation, it is a partnership not just of the private providers or the public providers, but it's actually also with civil society and also among the consumers themselves. And I think the traditional debate around what is the better model, whether it's a privately provided model or publicly provided model, I think sort of misses the point. Because I think that the arrival of the baby boomers into the aging cohort will be agnostic about whether it's public provider or private provider. They just want to have the right options. And right now, I think they're both in public and private. They have a lot of work to do on getting some better options.
I agree. It isn't about private or public. It's one. It's unified in providing options for the baby boomers, like you say, purpose, vibrancy, life, longevity, also choices of how they want to live in the later part of their life.
Yeah.
Very true. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to you. And I'm so glad that we connected. I learned so much and I'm thankful for the fact that a lot of your values and principles align with what I envision. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah. So let's stay in touch and let's see how we can collectively so advocate and bring up more people into the discussion and into the network. Because I think that I'm very excited by making connections like this. Mm-hmm. And I'll send you some other people that I've connected to. And they will be more than happy to actually then get to know your connections and actually talk to you as well.
Great. I would love that. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Real pleasure to talk to you. And let's stay in touch.
Absolutely. Take care.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us this week on Boomer Living Podcast. Make sure to visit our website, boomerliving.tv, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and other platforms. This way, you'll never miss a show. And while you're at it, If you found value in this show, we would really appreciate a rating in iTunes or simply tell a friend about the show. That would help us tremendously. Be sure to tune in weekly for our next episode. And remember, growing old is the purest and the most positive experience of human existence.